Hi, this is Gary, and welcome to the Simplicity Zen podcast. If you're watching this on YouTube, if you could take a moment, hit subscribe, the alert button, and like the video, I'd appreciate it. It helps motivate YouTube to distribute this podcast to a wider amount of random people. If you're watching this or listening to this on a podcast app, you can subscribe to that app. You could also go to our website, which is simplicityzen.com. And sign up for the mailing list there. And I love to hear from people. So if you'd like to email me from there, you can do that as well. Today, my guest is Scott Thornton. He's a longtime Zen practitioner in the Sambo Zen tradition, where he's an assistant teacher. He has been a student of Rubin Hapato Roshi at Maria Kanon Zen Center in Dallas, Texas for 22 years, and now is a member of Mountain Cloud Zen Center in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He's a musician and a professional psychologist. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.
So, so you and your wife, you guys just moved to Santa Fe.
Yeah, quite a move.
How's it moving from a big city to kind of a, it's not a resort town, but kind of a smaller town?
It's certainly a tourist town and a cultural hotbed. There are few cities that I would say in America that are less alike than Dallas and Santa Fe. Zen is everywhere. And so yeah, that's the main ingredient, that's the main continuity. But gosh, I miss that traffic in Dallas. It's just
Skeptical.
yeah.
I'm kind of obsessed with Mexican and Southwest food. Like, so I really want to go to Santa Fe just for the food, like the Hatch chilies.
Yeah.
Is it pretty amazing?
Oh, it's amazing. Yeah. They have two kinds of chili. They probably have more than two, but they have two ones that they tout. And one is green and the other is red. And there's, they're very different. And when you go to a restaurant, you say, "Give me Christmas." And they give you both.
Is it very distinctive, the
Yeah.
flavors?
Yeah. Very. Yeah. Unlike anywhere else I've had chili.
I'm sure most people subscribe to this podcast for food stuff, so
Yeah, let's continue.
so your official kind of position is assistant Zen teacher. Could you describe what that actually means in the organization?
Yeah, it's just a kind of step along the way. Assistant teachers don't have a great deal of authority, and we're really basically we can teach people to meditate. We can teach them the forms. We can teach them, the basics about Zen, and it kind of stops there as far as our official capacities. We stretch it a little bit here at Mountain Cloud and at Maria Kanon Zen Center. Assistant teachers and even some senior students are invited to give a Dharma talk from time to time. I've done a few of those, and I've been meeting with individual students, not in Doksan, but just one-to-one kind of meditation guidance, we'd call it.
But not, but you're not offering koan study. Where did you, so are you, sorry, are you still practicing as a practicing psychologist, or are you retired?
I'm still practicing a little. When COVID came along, I quickly converted my hospital practice to a video practice. And didn't think I would like it much, but I actually do. And so it's been particularly convenient when we moved here. I still have a Texas license to practice psychology, and all my clients are from Texas, and all my referral sources are in Texas. So I'm still a Texas psychologist, you could say. And I've got other things to do here that, so I'm not really pursuing that professional line here in New Mexico. They've asked me to be the director of the residential program here at Mountain Cloud. So I'm getting that, I'm working that up right now. So that's a nice.
What kind of psychology do you do? Is it like kind of cognitive behavioral therapy, or a little more old
Yeah,
school, or?
it's very general. I've been a psychologist for 34 years now. Started out as a Jungian in my heart, There wasn't a lot of that going on where I went to school, and but it was cognitive and behavioral approaches were really the mainstay by that time. But there was still an old guard of ego psychologists, Freudian, psychoanalytic types. And my favorite was a Gestalt. My favorite professor was a Gestalt therapist, and so I learned a lot about that and humanism. So I'm a kind of a mixed bag, but basically, in the end, I think I probably fall in the school of Carl Rogers, you know.
Does your Zen practice inform your psychoanalytic practice, or not psychoanalytic, but psychology practice, or are they totally different domains for you?
They complement each other a lot. I probably teach about one out of three people I meet. Probably I teach some kind of form of meditation too, for symptom management or just for kind of integrating themselves. But I think perhaps even more important than that, I think it's a good thing for therapists to be meditators. It helps me at least to be more present and to listen more accurately and empathically, and there are resistances to different types of personalities that I have, like everybody does, and helps me kind of see through that sometimes.
As head of residential practice, is that, am I phrasing that right?
Yeah,
What
resident residence program. Yeah.
are your responsibilities there? What do
Well,
you
we're
do?
still developing it. We don't have any residents yet. There have been at Mount McLeod in the past, but I guess because of my assistant teacher status and my skill set as a psychologist, I thought I might be a good fit for this kind of thing. So what we're going to do is invite, there will be a maximum of seven residents at any given time. And they'll stay here for, you could measure it in months probably that they would be in residence at Mountain Cloud. Fairly rustic living situation, and but a step up from camping, but still there'll be in cabins and cottages, and they'll basically just have an immersive Zen experience where we'll sit together for an hour every morning and an hour every evening, and they have samu, work practice, for an hour and a half a day or so, and I'll meet with everybody individually for meditation guidance once a week or so, and then we'll have group meetings to just for community building, and we want to interface with the local sangha as well. That's been the sangha around here is hungry for in-person stuff because of the deprivations of COVID. Just starting to come back in the zendo now, and it's just really alive.
Do you guys wear masks in the Zendo?
We do, yeah. When there's any number of people here, we do. When there may be three or four people, no, because it's a very large zendo. But yeah, when there are 20 people in here, we're masking up.
Yeah, I'm really struggling with I wear like N95 masks,
Yeah.
and I can do it for a couple sittings, but and I've done it for multiple days, Sachin, but man, it's just so hard for me. I get all stuffed up and I can't breathe and
Yeah.
really
I know.
struggle with it.
Yeah, we're an N95 as well, and especially after Kinhen, and we're at altitude here, and I'm not used to it yet. But after our walking meditation, I'm huffing and puffing, and to put that, to sit down with that thing on is hard.
And plus, I pinches your nose, you have to breathe out your mouth. But it's just another thing to experience. But it's definitely a physical challenge for me. So the students who come for the residential program, are they going to work with Henry and Valerie as well at Mount Cloud, or this
Well,
is Henry Shookman and your wife Valerie, for people who don't know?
yeah. They'll certainly interact with them. If anybody gets to the point where I think they're having any kind of experience, any sort of kensho, I'll definitely bump them up to Valerie and Henry, for to really get their koan study going. But they're gonna, in addition to the brief sketch I gave you of their day, they'll also attend all the session, all all the Thursday night Dharma talks, the Zazen Kai, any kind of special event. Anytime there's an event in Zendo, they're more or less required to be there. You know, it's just part of the experience. And so they're going to get a lot of teaching from Valerie and Henry that way.
Yeah. So are they put on, you mentioned Kenzo, are they put on Mu right away, or are they doing more kind of preliminary falling breaths and stuff like that?
Going to be doing more preliminary stuff, but I think I'll have the authority to offer Mu if this aspiration seems right. I'll talk it over with the teachers before I do that. But yeah, one could start with Mu, or maybe even a simpler one, you know, what is this, or who cool. are you, or who hears, one of those.
Cool. Yeah. So is there a fee for this program? Are they,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, we haven't determined the fees yet, but if you're in the cottage and it's a nicer arrangement, you have, you know, plumbing, and you have a little kitchenette, and there's, you know, a communal bathroom. And if you're in a cabin, it's a little harsher. So they have heat, but that's about it, and electricity. But we'll charge less for those units than the others. We're not sure about the price point yet.
For, you know, kind of younger people who without an income, do you think there'll be any sort of work trade practice or?
Yeah, we have to have a scholarship component. And everyone will be doing some work, and they'll also get their breakfast and lunch Monday through Friday will be free. We're trying to make it affordable, but obviously there'll be some people who can't even afford the modest prices that we're suggesting. So if it seems like somebody that we really want to have that really could use this kind of experience, we'll try to make adjustments.
That's great. Yeah, I remember when I was in my teens and started practicing, you know, that, you know, I really look back and really appreciate the generosity of centers that let me essentially go practice for free. I didn't have any money, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, like less than zero. You know?
Yeah.
Yeah. Like, I mean, it was, you know, pivotal. So.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. Yeah. I've heard of places that actually pay people to be there, you know.
Really?
I think they actually work them a lot, but you know.
Still. Oh yeah. I mean, I guess San Francisco Zen Center, you get like when I was at Sonoma Mountain Zen Center, I think I got like $20 a month, you know, just to buy like toothpaste and stuff, you know.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So could you talk a little bit about where you grew up and kind of what that was like and so forth?
Yeah, I grew up in the South. I was born in a little place called Tunica, Mississippi, which is a very small town close to the Mississippi River. We moved when I was in third grade to Clarksdale, Mississippi, which is a little bit upriver. And then in fourth grade, my father got a job in Memphis. So we moved to Memphis, and I spent most of my life there. Got through high school and college in Memphis.
Yeah, you have no accent at all that I can hear, at least.
Oh, good. Thank you. That would delight Valerie to hear that. Or surprise her, I would say. I'm on my best behavior right now. When I'm tired or angry or whatever, it comes out.
Yeah, nothing wrong with accents, but... Was that, were your parents conservative or more liberal, or were they worldly?
They were Democrats, but that was different back then.
Right. Dixiecrat.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
I'm born in 1951, just to give you some perspective on that. But, you know, they did vote for Kennedy, and they did vote for Johnson. But they were Baptists, and so I grew up in a fairly conservative religious background. My mother was quite devout, in fact. My father was, you know, polite about it. But they were conservative, but they weren't. These days that means something different. I think they were centrist, I would say.
Were they? Were you a believer as a child?
Yeah, I was a pretty reverent kid. And, you know, in the Baptist church, you decide that you want to be baptized in theory. I mean, really, there's a lot of social pressure to say, I'm ready. But it's not a thing that happens in your infancy. It's more like grade school. And So I went through that process, but I had a really powerful experience about a week after being baptized. It's like I really felt God loves me. I just had this amazing sense of gratitude. And I don't go for all that dogma anymore, but that feeling, that sense of the universe loves me is still with me, you know.
Do you think that was kind of a like a taste of Kensho or
I do, yeah.
yeah.
I really do. There was a brilliant kind of silvery light that kind of came with it, and I had another one similar to that while in the church one day. It was a, we would go to church on Wednesday nights also in a very small group. People, I was sitting alone in a pew before the preacher came on. There was a organ music going on, and there's just that vibration of the big pipe organ got in my body, and that sort of wonderment came again at that time. I had a couple
Do
of times
you
like
think there was a kind of shift in identity there, or is it mostly, or is it still a lot of kind of object subject like perception?
that's a great question. I hadn't really contemplated it. As I recall the moment, yeah, I would say I was gone.
Yeah, it's interesting. So I've interviewed Henry and Valerie, and both of very, I think, susceptible to kind of shifts like that. And I wonder if people with that kind of in their DNA, I wonder if they're more apt to like, gravitate towards something like Sambo that values that.
That's probably the case. I would say that's probably the case. I didn't gravitate towards Sambo myself. It was just available,
What was there,
Actually, I'd read Three Pillars of Zen. I'd been practicing on my own for about 12 years, really, really devotedly. And I read Three Pillars of Zen and really got this vivid picture of what it's like to be in Sesshin and Doksan and Kensho, and I wanted that. And I was talking to my stepdaughter, who is only 10 years younger than me, and she said, "Hey, I've been trying to tell you, Reuben Hobito is right over here. He's right in that lineage." I go, "Okay, I'll check it out." And yeah, it was love at first sight, So I just got.
So at your age, you're kind of, I think, perfectly suited for kind of the explosion of many things in the 60s, is that right? Were you, I mean, were you part of that, or were you kind of more straight and narrow?
I was square in the middle of it. I was actually in the musical Hair, and I didn't have to act. I was really believing every word of it,
So were you were a musician at the time?
My first, before I was a psychologist, I was in theater and specialized in rock musicals, so I was in things like Hair and Tommy, and I've been playing guitar since I was a teenager.
What bands from that time really stood out to you?
I was a big Bob Dylan fan for one, and I was just blown over by the Beatles and Rolling Stones, the Who. I saw the Who just a few months ago. And so I like those English guys a lot. And then Crosby, Stills, and Nash were influential. I still like to listen to Neil Young a lot. So I was both a folky and a rocker.
Did you ever catch like Allman Brothers or the Grateful Dead or like more improvisational bands?
I never saw them live. I certainly listened to them, but I never got to catch them live, no.
How about psychedelics? Were you interested in those at all?
Yeah, I checked that out back then. We had these sort of street psychedelics that I'm not sure were as good or as clean or as helpful as some of the plant-based things, but I did try that out. And then there were toward my when I was in my 20s, twice I was given some magic mushrooms, but never in a. It was always in a kind of a conducive setting.
Recreational.
Yeah,
Oh, or what?
recreational, conducive setting, quiet, I wasn't out in the streets or anything. but it was not, you know, under the guidance of, you know, a shaman or anything like that.
Wasn't reverent, right?
No.
Were any of those experiences meaningful to you, or were they just kind of fun?
Yeah, mostly they were just kind of fun, but I remember once with the magic mushrooms that I did have a probably I don't know what to call it when it's drug induced, but a kind of opening experience with that.
And so, did you major in psychology or music or both, or?
My undergraduate degree was in theater, when I went to the kind of the pinnacle of my theater career was in my late in mid 20s. I was in New York and happened to be invited to audition for Hair again and got into
Okay.
production there.
So, like a pro, so you were actually a working actor. Oh, interesting.
I'd been regional prior to that, and this was like the first and only exposure to the big time. And the show closed after about 4 months, and there I was with a wife and two children, and I auditioned most every day, sometimes twice a day, for various things. I had a couple of agents because of being in the show, you know, so I got to go to a lot of auditions, and I was getting better at it. But yeah, the competition there is pretty fierce. And I started reading Jung and began to see that first I was really intrigued. I'd had a little bit of experience with therapy with my family and liked the therapists a lot. And practically speaking, it made more sense to become a psychologist than to wonder if I'd ever work again as an actor. So I changed course.
So did you go, did you get a master's, or did you have to go back and get a bachelor's and
I had to go back and be a non-matriculant. I got 23 hours of undergraduate psychology in order to qualify for graduate school.
And this is in New York.
No, we left New York, and rather than go back to Memphis, where the economy was in a shambles like it was most places, this was 1978, and there was a big recession going on. Dallas and Denver were two cities where you could work and go to school and still kind of survive, and we had family and friends in Dallas, and it was closer to Memphis than was Denver, so we just chose Dallas and went there. And I'd read about the school that I hoped to get into, and eventually did get into. Actually, in a New York library, I read about the school that I ended up going to.
And you, so was it hard to establish your psychology practice after, after kind of your all the hours you had to do and everything? Was that a hard transition, or was it easy to find clients, or?
You know, I was young enough that it didn't seem so hard. I don't know if I could possibly do that again. It was a rigorous program. And I was working as a bellhop while I went to night school. So it wasn't like a high stress job or anything like that. And the tips were pretty good. So I was surviving pretty well. But once I got into to graduate school, there was no way to work. So fortunately, my father lent me some money, and my wife had money that she invested in our future by helping me go to school.
And so were you, did you have a meditation practice at this point, or did that come later?
That came a little later. I graduated from school. I mean, I finished school in 1984, and had to work on my dissertation at that point, and finally got licensed. I got my degree in 86, and then I had to do my internship. And so I got licensed in 1988. And the weekend that I sat for my license exam is the weekend I picked up a book by Lawrence Lushan called How to Meditate.
Okay. Oh, I
It's
think I've seen that.
a little book, it's really nice. It was out of print for a while, but I think it's back in print now. And he had just a dozen or two dozen different ways to meditate. And the one that just kind of struck me was breath counting. So I started counting my breath on a March day in 1988. And so it was very early in my psychology career.
What led you towards meditating? Like what was the appeal to you?
You know, I have two answers for that. One is having just finished this long process of becoming a psychologist, I had one of those moments. It's like, really? This is it? You know, it just seemed like something was missing. And the other thing is, as an actor, on a couple of occasions, I had to act like I was meditating. In Hair, the lead character comes out to center stage before the show starts, while the band is warming up and the cast is milling around in the audience saying hi and, you know, kind of cutting up. But Claude, the character, comes out and sits in meditation for about 15, 20 minutes as everything starts to, and then the first song starts, you know, this is the dawning of the age of Aquarius, and it all just sort of unfolds around Claude sitting. And so the director said, well, just sit there. And he wasn't a meditator, but he told him to straighten my back, you know, leave my eyes open. And it was, you know, in retrospect, it was meditating. I mean, you know, if you act like you're meditating, you're probably meditating, you know.
And so you felt something intuitive with that, or?
Yeah, it's something really, yeah, something connected. And, you know, there was this other thing, it's silly, but there was this other book back in the 70s called A Child's Garden of Grass. And it was about how everything's better on wheat, you know. So you want to go to a movie, you know, smoke a joint. You want to enjoy your meal, smoke a joint. You want to meditate, smoke a joint. And so, okay, I'll try that, you know. And so they gave you a mantra by, as I recall, I could be wrong, but I think, you know, you're supposed to toke up and then get a phone book and open it up and point to any part of the book and then look at it. And whatever that syllable was the first part of your mantra. And then you open it up again. And, you know, so like this. So I got my mantra that way. I actually used that mantra for a good while. I can still remember.
Was it like Jones Rebecca or something?
What's that?
Was your mantra like Jones Rebecca or something?
Something like that. Yeah. It was like, it turned out it was Un, Yelly, Moan. So three different names with those.
Yeah.
And God, I feel weird. I'm talking about magic mushrooms and weed here, and that is not our path, you know. But you know, that's what was happening back then.
No, I mean, it's your path was your path. Is what's led you up to this point.
You're right.
So, did you feel any like? I mean, what was your slide into meditation just kind of like, oh, I'll try this, or did you feel kind of any sort of desperation?
It wasn't desperate. It felt a little urgent, but not desperate. You know, what happened was within minutes I was hooked. I mean, I really had a, you know, I didn't know the word then, but I had a distinct samadhi my first time I sat.
It is with or without pot?
Without.
Okay.
I was straight. Yeah, I was just sitting outdoors on top of a pile of bricks to stay away from, you know, I had dogs that were outside, so I got up on this pile of bricks so that they wouldn't be all over me, and started counting my breath, and I didn't miss a day, really. I probably meditated for about an hour a day. Then on, at least. And the breath counting evolved a little bit. I didn't have the vocabulary for it, but what I was doing was listening to the sounds of the world. And this beautiful kind of experience of not differentiating between what's a pleasant sound or a noxious sound, just letting every sound hear me, so to speak.
Some more like open awareness, or even chikantaza, just some degree. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it sounds like you kind of had that solo practice for a long time and then kind of blundered into the lucky blunder into Habato Roshi.
Lucky blunder, yeah.
Yeah. Could you talk a little bit about your first time visiting there?
Yeah, so memorable. We were staying, had our zendo, we rented a space from a Methodist church in downtown Dallas, up on the second floor. It's a beautiful zendo.
I'm surprised they rented to you guys.
Reuben is a professor of comparative religion and at Southern Methodist University, so he has a lot of Methodist contacts. They're currently renting from another Methodist church, so
Interesting.
so there I was for my first sit there, the first time that I was there with Reuben. I had gone for the orientation, and so there was a zazenkai, and for those who don't know what that means, that's an all-day sit, on a Saturday. And I knew I was going to meet the teacher this day, so I was very excited. So I was sitting facing the wall, and right where I was sitting, there was a photograph on the wall of some kind with a kind of a plexiglass frame over it. So it was reflective, a little bit warped. And so they started doing that little ring of the bell for to let the teacher enter the zendo, and I could just feel this hush, this vibe. And Reuben walked behind me, and his reflection in the plexiglass there, that frame, all warped and everything, just exuded so much love. I mean, I was just struck right away that sounds corny kind of, but I just fell in love with the man from his reflection. And then I met him that day, and he gave me mu.
And Dokusan. You guys call it Dokusan? What do you call the private meeting?
We call it Doksan.
And what kind of instructions did he give you for Mu? Was it, did he just t he told you he told you this little story,
Or the
and then
dog.
just told you to focus on Mu or?
Yeah, just focus on Mu. And I'd read about Mu, I'd read The Gateless Gate. So it wasn't like I was surprised by what he told me, but yeah, just told me to not cogitate about what it means, but just to intone Mu and let that dissolve me.
Did he have you like do it on the out breath? Did he talk about breath at all?
Yeah, as I that's how I did it, and it was definitely an out breath. Nowadays, I think that's that. I don't know that he would present it precisely like that now. I'm not sure, but yeah, it was to hear him in tone. It was just so good. So that was the sound I had in my head, I guess, when I was moving.
What was his vibe in Dokusan? Was he like serious and intense or like relaxed and mellow? You know, what's his Dokusan demeanor like?
He has two or three gears, and back then he used the Japanese gear a lot more. I call it the Japanese gear. It's like wouldn't look at you, kind of like that. But his laughter would be booming too if there was something delightful that happened. I remember sitting outside the Doksan room waiting for my turn, hearing that laugh and wondering what it takes to make that guy laugh like that. So he could be very warm too, and I've known him now all these years, and know him as just a real kind and sweet guy. So when I see the stone face, I don't buy it,
Yeah, skillful means, I guess.
Yeah.
So did you so was it weekly that you that group met?
We met several times a week. He would do Doksan on Wednesday nights and on once a month on Saturdays, and then session. I couldn't go that often. I went to Doksan basically once a month for many years.
And would you go to Sesshin?
Once a year, I went to a Labor Day session, so regular but sparse kind of interaction with him for the first 9 years. My wife died in 2009, and so I had a sudden kind of opening in my life that I filled with Zen.
Was that totally unexpected?
Her death?
Yeah.
No, we knew for a year she was dying.
I'm sorry.
Thanks. Yeah. She had what's called idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis. Fiber builds up in your lungs, and they don't know what caused it. Probably a medication that she was taking. But anyway,
Were your kids grown at that point?
they were her kids. They were my stepkids,
Oh, I see.
and they were they were adults. We had grandchildren by then. But as she was toward the end of her life, the last few months, she told me several times when she was gone, she wanted me to go to the Zen Center, because she knew how much it meant to me, and thought it was healthy and wholesome, and so she really encouraged me to do that. So I appreciate that.
She didn't sit herself.
She came once or twice, but no, she didn't meditate. She was a dancer. That was her practice.
Professional, like ballet or jazz or
She was ballet, and modern dance was her main thing, and experimental theater.
that how you guys met through the theater scene? So at that point you kind of kicked up your practice and the gear.
Going to every session I could. That's when I met Henry, back in those days. And that's, shortly after that is when Valerie and I found each other. And from 2009 to 2014, I just was going to Doksan a lot. And from that, I got to the point where I was invited to go to Kenshikai. That's the process of becoming an assistant teacher.
What kind of threshold do you think you passed that where you started being invited to that? Like what?
Getting to the end of the koan curriculum,
I see.
I guess I don't know. Everybody's got different curricula, but we have first we do usually move, and then the miscellaneous koans, and then the gateless gate, and then the Blue Cliff Record, doing the English names here, and then the Book of Serenity, and then the Light of Transmission. Then we do the precepts, and by the time you get to the end of the Shoyo Roku, the Light of Transmission, you start to get invited to go to Kenshikai.
Do you guys do five ranks as well? Is that the last thing you do? It is after the precepts. If you don't mind, you don't have to talk about it if you don't want, but can you talk a little bit about your process of working on mu and passing mu and so forth?
Well, yeah, I worked on it for I think 2.5 years. Basically intoning mu on the out breath. My experience of mu is that it was like a often like a solvent or maybe a blade cutting through things that would arise. And there was a vibratory, kind of a physical vibratory experience that I had as well that could be associated with the first jhana, I think. And it reminded me a bunch of those two experiences I mentioned from childhood. Sometimes the zendo would seem to fill up with that weird light, and then I was at a Labor Day session in 2002. And the what happened was I was it was toward the it was the last day. It was actually Labor Day, and toward the end of the day, and I felt this piercing pain in my heart area, and everything just sort of began to collapse around that, and I felt like I was just going to explode with joy. And I just kept trying to hold it in so I wouldn't disturb others. And when Kenhen came, I exited and I ran out into the, we had this, by the time we owned our own Zendo, and we had this beautiful acreage, all these trees and wildlife and everything. So I just ran out in the middle of that, and everything was so intimate. I mean, clouds were, embracing me, and trees were dancing with me, and rabbits were teasing me, and so I just jumped up and down for a long time with nature and trees and stuff, and then it was time to stop the guess you'd call it the Jisha, came out and said, saw what was happening, and said, ah, dancing with delight, huh? Yeah, and said, yeah, and so that was my first opening, big.
Yeah, how did you, so you went to do Dokusan. Did you even have to present, or did he just was like, okay, yeah, you're ready?
I didn't get to go to the session was over.
Okay.
And this was before I was going a lot, So he had heard about it, from the person who saw me. And so he asked me to tell him about it, and I told him about it. Said, well, yeah, it's very nice, And then so I didn't think much more about it. I knew it was very meaningful to me, and it didn't really matter much to me, that I had passed Mu or anything. But I saw him, the next time I saw him, some weeks later, and he said, I've been thinking about your experience. And he asked me to describe it to him again, and then he started giving me the check-in questions, and they were just like knocking down bowling pins, or they were just so simple, how it is when you're there. And so he said, we got to the, well, I don't want to give too much away because, and then I would have to kill everybody. But
There was one podcast where after it, I went back and actually deleted, because I'm like, oh, he kind of gave away a coin answer.
yeah, you know, but I got to that last question, and he goes, with that, I usher you through the gate of Mu.
And so, yeah, so you said that was your first opening. How did the other ones differ in quality and
I haven't had that many. I had another one that was similarly powerful. It was in 2010, I believe. It's right here in Santa Fe. We'd gone to the North American Sanbo Zen conference and had a very powerful session. And the moment that it happened, I'd been, I don't know how much time we have, but
Yeah,
there.
funny.
There was this moment where I was sitting in Zazen, and I actually nodded off a little. I had a little dream. It was a cartoon bluebird was came rushing at me, and I kind of woke up, And so I settled back down and kind of nodded off again, and my deceased wife came rushing at me. In her glory form, I mean, in her dancing days, her youth, and I was wild, and that funny light started to happen, and later I had Doksan with Yamada Rion. I told him about that, and he said, "Whoa, your wife actually came here. Your deceased wife actually came here." I said, "Yeah." Yeah. He said, well, she's joined the practice. And thought that was kind of nice. And then some days later, in that same session, was just I sat uncharacteristically, I sat 3 rounds in a row without walking. So I sat like for an hour and a half after having heard a really strong Teisho. And it was lunchtime. So I rose to go get in line at the cafeteria, stumbled or lost my balance and fell up against an adobe wall. And the texture of that wall on my arm.
Was it this center, by the way?
No, we were at the Carmelite retreat center.
Okay.
This center wasn't big enough for that. But the texture of that adobe on my arm just woke me up, and very similar experience to the one I described before. I went outside, and I just wanted to touch everything. Flowers, trees, even lawn chairs. I mean, everything was just so perfect and exquisite. And so I think my experiences now, I have a little bit of language for them, more like oneness. And I don't know that I've actually experienced what I'm hearing people say about goneness, except, when you were asking me about those early experiences, they were a little bit more like goneness. Perhaps for a kid. And I've had little similar things, but for me, for whatever reason, so far, the opening experiences I've had have all come through the sense of touch or skin.
Yeah. So the kind of the luminosity and light that you feel in the room, I'd like to ask you about that because I kind of have similar experiences. I had one kind of thing, and then that involved that, and then since then it becomes really easy with sitting. And for me, it has a real sense of purity. Does that
Yeah,
resonate at all?
precisely that.
Yeah.
Just a pure, holy kind of light.
Yes, really. It's something. I mean, especially at Sesshin, it gets really intense, like almost like too intense sometimes. So you started going to the teacher Sesshins. So what was it like working with koans with him versus Habato, the abbot?
Yeah, the abbot is more demanding, I would say. Reuben doesn't give it away either. But the abbot has, it seems, very specific answers he's looking for. It's like he gets a new insight into a koan, and he wants everyone around him, that he's teaching, to get the same insight. So he'll. Yeah, I only get to see him once a year or so, for these occasions. So maybe two or three doksan on that occasion, that week, and then a year goes by and see him again. So I've worked on the same koan with him sometimes for 3 years, and he's just looking for something in particular. Reuben, I think, is more like open to, oh, there's that's an that's an yeah that that's a new way to see that. Even though with the abbot, I've given him sort of presentations to koans that he says, that's perfect, now tell me why. So go back and sit with that,
Is he, you said like Ruben had like the Japanese mode. Is he all Japanese mode? The abbot?
He's not even looking at you when you come in. Looking at his notes, seeing who you are. Oh
And how does he, so obviously you've been through the koan curriculum, so how's he picking which koan to give you? So it's kind of
yeah.
almost at random, or
I don't think it's random, but they are certainly not in any sequence or anything. He gave me, "Where will you go when you die?" That's the last one he gave me. But before that, he had given me the one with the cow passes through the window, through the glass window.
Why was tail not deserved?
Why won't his tail go through? Horns and legs go through the one with the tail. And that one took me a couple of years to get the way he wanted it. And then I was working with Where Will You Go When You Die for 2 or 3 years, and like I say, I had the answer that he accepted, but he couldn't exactly explain that to them. So he took me back to the cow, and this last time I saw him, and I look forward to seeing him again. I think I've reconnected with that one, but I was thrown off guard that day.
Yeah, interestingly, that's one of the koans that Hakuin considered, hard to pass.
Or,
And I think a koan that he would give people towards the end of their practice, to kind of like, okay, like let's see how deep you really are,
it's we just do them in sequence. So that's number, I can't remember, 28 perhaps, of the Gateless Gate, something like that. And so in my first pass through that was in those early years with Ruben. And he said as much. He said, this is a very difficult koan, and at that level, a student, they don't really expect you to get the depth of it. And so you can describe what that koan's about in kind of cognitive ways, or just intellectual ways, and get something out of it. But there one or two of them are like that, where it would be crushing and discouraging to a student to run up against that koan and never get past it, So we'll pick it up at a deeper level next time through, is sort of the attitude, I think.
So could you describe a little bit what you like, what have you done, like when you pass a koan, what do you think this the shift is for you? Like, can you talk about a little bit about just like just a random koan, like like what so you do you sit with it, or is it just kind of in the background, or how would you how do you approach koans?
Typically, I sit with what feels like the heart of the koan, the one line or the one gesture or whatever, that seems to be the heart of it. And I'll do, I guess, when I sit on any given occasion, I'll recall the koan and then let it kind of drift into the background, and occasionally just bring it back. And when it shifts, oftentimes there's just this recognition, there's just like, ah, yeah, of course. And I feel lighter often. Oftentimes, I'm that close, and I'll go to Doksan and it'll shift in Doksan, and those are particularly nice. Just feel like somebody's kind of wiped away the crud from your eyes,
Yeah, there's been a couple times where I'll be given a koan, and I'll just have a really quick sense of what the answer is, but it'll get time to like close the Dokusan, and I'll think like, oh, and like somehow like my brain will like grasp for like a more like conceptual response. I'm like, oh, that's probably it, and then I'll give the conceptual answer, that's not it, and then I'll do my original answer, and that was it. Like, it's always when I switch at the last minute like that, it's always wrong, and the original one was the right one. It's happened to me like 5 or 6 times or something.
I've had that happen too. Isn't it funny? And also those moments where you just didn't hit it, when you're there in Doksan, and when you're walking out of the Doksan room, it falls on you. I can't wait to come back,
I feel like I get more from the ones I struggle with sometimes, because it's a little bit more of a epiphany, or a release, the ones that are just instantly obvious are not, I don't feel like they do much for me.
My if anybody's hating koans, don't despair. The tough ones really do reward you.
I mean, I think hating is part of the fun, right?
I haven't heard it put that way, but yeah.
So are those the only two teachers you've done koan work with? Have you worked with Henry or even your wife, or?
I'm working with Henry now, and actually went to Doksan with Valerie. Ruben's pretty open about it. He doesn't require you to just work with him. So there were occasions when Valerie was a teacher for a long time, and before we even knew each other much, I went to Duxon with her a couple of times. Ruben's wife, Maria Habito, is also a teacher, and I went to Duxon with her once. I went to Duxon with Joan Reek one time, Roshi.
Oh, that was Henry's teacher, right?
Yeah, she substituted for Ruben a few times when he was in Japan for a while. And I was still working on Mu. I went to Duxon with her one time. And I've been to Duxon with Yamada Rion numerous times, Henry now quite a few times. There was, a wonderful woman in Germany named Gudrun, who I've been to Duxon with a couple times, a Roshi. And there was one other, I think. All I can recall.
Do they all have like vastly different styles and energies? And I mean, I guess it's an obvious yes.
Yeah, they tend to be pretty different, yeah, I can hear and recognize Yamada Rion in Valerie and in Henry, and I can hear Ruben in them sometimes. So I imagine, if I get to the point where I'm really doing Doksan regularly, I'll be having to work at not channeling those people,
So it sounds like you're cycling back through the curriculum.
More
And
randomly,
so there's the there's Mu, and then the checking questions, and then the miscellaneous koans, and then Gateless Gate, and then Blue Cliff Record. As you're going through the different collections, do you feel like a collection in itself has a spirit or a style that's different than the other collections? If so, could you kind of elaborate a little bit what you see as the different?
Yeah, the miscellaneous are fun. I mean, those are kind of a kick, and they serve a real purpose. They really help keep that momentum going, from your own experience. The Mumenkan, my adjective for that would be it's warmer. It has a more friendly feel. The Hekigan or the Blue Cliff is a little more austere to me. And I don't know if I don't have a strong sense of the Shoyoroku, but the what I'd say about that, I guess, is that it's has this sort of loftiness about it to me. And then the Dankoroku is it's just kind of exciting to see this one master after the other after the other after the other get it,
What part? Oh, actually, I'm not gonna ask that. How do I articulate this? So when you're revisiting the koans, you obviously can't just give you the same answer, right? So I mean, like, how do you approach a koan you've already worked with?
Yeah, I try to take it fresh. I can't help it. I look at my notes, just, full disclosure, I look at my notes, but I usually
I'm telling Henry, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
I look at them and I really typically see now that's pretty thin now. I can't go near that. It does help go ahead and get that off the table, though. It's like, and if I really thought, that was it, then, okay, maybe that will end up being presented. But I'll typically re-examine the notes and then basically put them aside and start working with the koan again fresh. And you know, I think I see things better now than I did then. So I wouldn't want to give the same answer, even if I thought it was right.
So I'm curious. So have you taken Jukai?
Yes.
Who did you do that with?
With Rion Roshi.
And was that here's your bakusu, or was there a ceremony, or?
Yeah, it was Rakusu. It was at Kinshikai, and it was powerful. He was really quite the. It was quite a ceremony.
Was this something you guys did in private, or was it with a group, in
It was,
front of a group?
there were several of us doing it at the same time.
So there wasn't an audience, it was just the participants.
No, there was an audience.
Okay.
We were either at Kinshikai or. Yeah, it was in Europe, so we were not doing an ask. It was a Kinshikai retreat, and it's the only time I've seen it done this way. I mean, the only time I've seen it at all. But there were five of us or so, and he had spent the past number of months doing the calligraphy for the Rakusu.
Was the ceremony in English?
Yes.
So you did the, I take refuge the refuges and the and do you guys do disavow your evil karma and stuff like that? And so did you study the precepts going up? Well, I guess there's the precepts in the Quran curriculum,
Yeah,
but
we
did
I
you?
spent the precepts with Ruben, and then so this was a more of a ceremony.
But would you study the precepts from kind of a non-dual perspective, or did you guys talk about them kind of more kind of conceptually?
Both we talked about them in conceptual terms, but also looking at them from the point of view of the essential world rather than just the relative world.
And did you get a bloodline? So I geek out on this stuff, I'm sorry. But did you get a bloodline certificate as well? Or no? Okay. Okay, cool. So I'm curious, what kind of demographics are you guys getting at Mount Cloud? Is it kind of an o older crowd, or are you getting younger people coming in?
It's a good mix. I don't see a lot of people in their 20s, but everybody looks young to me, right? So I do see a number of people in their 30s and 40s and 50s. But there is definitely a mode of silver dragons here. We got a lot of old timers with white hair.
Cool. All right. Well, those were kind of questions I wanted to touch on. Is there anything you'd like to talk about, or?
Wow, no, this has been a lot of fun. Valerie told me that you had been interested in her background as a theologian in a Christian tradition, and how that compared to Zen. And I liked being able to tell you my childhood stories. And curious about what was your upbringing like?
Are you asking me? Or are you saying, okay. What was my, a very atheist, 100% atheist. I got baptized in the Catholic Church as a baby, and then no memory of church at all until, much later. I went with a friend in college. So I was completely, just, I thought religion was superstition, I actually got kicked out of the Cub Scouts for admitting not believing in God. And,
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and I think kicked out of a gifted program in a public school for saying
Man.
that because the teacher was really religious.
Wow.
And then yeah,
Really?
but so I was just, I guess you'd say I was a materialist, and but then I blundered into psychedelics and the Grateful Dead, and a couple years later I was living in a monastery. So
Wow, what a shift.
yeah.
I've been Henry was talking about a book. I should know the name and the author. It's kind of current about why I'm not a Buddhist.
What's his name? The English guy.
Well, you know who I'm talking about. Anyway, Henry was talking about that book the other day, and this kind of convenient separation of Zen from Buddhism in a way, in the West especially. And he talked about how even in Japan and in Asia that had been the case, that there had been a kind of like not disengagement, but a kind of a putting it to the side. It's not really emphasized, and makes Zen and Buddhism, for that matter, a little more palatable to the scientific mind or to the Western.
You know, it's funny. I practiced Zen for a long time, not really having any sort of understanding of basic Buddhist concepts at all. I mean, as crazy as that sounds, you know, I was just a Zazen practitioner, and so I kind of blundered into priest ordination and stuff too, and everything's been blundering in my life. But and so that teacher, he's really into like turning people into Dharma teachers, like that's his like main focus, and so I had to like kind of learn all the Buddhism 101 stuff, and it was really interesting how kind of learning like kind of basic like early Buddhism, like sutra type stuff. It kind of I was able to see the path of my practice better as a map, like like in retrospect, like oh okay, I get it, and I think I even had I don't know if I can fully articulate this. I've never tried to describe this before. I think there would have been some value having more basic Buddhism 101 stuff early on for me. I really got sucked into like the jhana experiences, and I think if I had the bigger picture, I would have seen like, oh, this is just a jhana experience, this is one example, and of course teachers could say that to you, but it's different, like when you kind of have a, I don't know. But like yeah, so I've kind of late in life, I've really come to appreciate, especially early Buddhism, kind of the core Buddhist teachings. I've really come to appreciate that in a significant way, which was just not on my roadmap at all for many, many, I mean decades really,
I get that. I was a purely a Zazen practitioner myself. The cosmology of Buddhism, reincarnation, those things just didn't interest me at all, and don't really that much now. But with the 101 stuff, though, I feel that same kind of need, and I need to catch up with that, especially now that I'm purporting to teach.
Right. And it's funny, I've become really passionate about kind of the neurobiology of Zen in the last couple of years. And I've actually long been interested in it. But the research just wasn't there. It's literally since, seems like starting like 2017, 2018, they've really started having the papers, the studies that starts really, of course there's no study that describes what conscious, like awareness is. I mean, attention, awareness, they know what brain networks, focus it, but they don't know what it is, if that makes sense. So I mean, I don't feel it's materialist because there's still plenty of mystery and magic and wonder, right? But it's gotten really good at describing samsara, like what is causing the problem. You know what I mean? And it's really interesting seeing that that is actually, I'll get some, and I'll read some paper, and I'll be like, oh, this is like the 12-step causation. I mean, it's really interesting seeing the correlation between kind of the Buddhism 101 and the research that's coming out. I mean, it totally backs it up. It's fascinating, really.
So they can really scientifically explain samsara, and they can intuitively grasp, nirvana, I guess.
Yeah, maybe. I mean, they have no idea why consciousness exists, and I don't think they ever will, 'cause I don't think it's a physical process. I don't think it's like, I mean, obviously the brain plays a role, but I mean, there's clearly some thing outside of the brain going on, at least in my opinion.
So you can use a phrase like unified field theory and say that's it, but that doesn't tell you anything. But the the thing about science is that there's an observer, and the thing about enlightenment is that there isn't.
I'll send it with that, like, 'cause I think that's the core message right there.
Right. Okay.
All right, cool.
Pleasure. Thank you, Barry.
Yeah, I really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Oh, yeah, so I'll put links to the Mountain Cloud website. People who want to get in touch with you. And so do you guys have information on the website about the residential program yet? Or is that forthcoming?
We had it up for one day, and then the board asked us to take it down because they didn't like the pricing. So
Oh, okay.
we're going to work on that with the finance committee, and there may be other issues, but we want to get it right. So
Okay.
we had it up for a few hours.
Okay. So if someone's interested, stay tuned.
Yeah, stay tuned.
Okay. Cool. All right. Thank you.